My name is Sandra Fehler, and I'm from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today, Wednesday, April 12, 2006, I'm interviewing June Dahl, Professor of Pharmacology in the School of Medicine and Public Health at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning. We'll start right at the beginning of your life. That would be all right.
Mm-hmm.
If you could talk about where and when you were born, describe your childhood, your early schooling, talk about your family, any teachers, family members, or others who encouraged you in your studies.
I was born in 1930 in June, and actually in a hospital in St. Paul, Minnesota. My parents lived in a small town across the St. Croix River, Hudson. But for some reason, instead of being born in Hudson, I was born in St. Paul, which is pretty trivial. The town I grew up in was very small. It was pretty poor, relatively speaking. The major source of employment was the railroad. The Chicago and Northwestern Railroad had a shop there where they built cars and they did repairs. When that closed, it had a terrible impact on the economy of the town. I went to a three-room schoolhouse. Grades 1, 2, and 3 were together, 4 and 5 were together, and 6 through 8 were together. And then I subsequently went into a high school that was part of a larger, was called a city, where we lived in a village, North Hudson versus Hudson, a high school, which also by the standards today was very small as well. There were only about 45 people in my graduating class. That was unusually small. Now that the city has grown because it's become a really commuter place where people come from their employment with Minnesota Mining and other companies that are in the area around St. Paul and Minneapolis. So it's really that kind of a community. It's very different. I was in this three-room schoolhouse, and I think my first grade teacher was quite exceptional. We had no enrichment activities. We learned reading and writing and arithmetic. We listened to Wisconsin School of the Air for our music, and there is, I blocked his name, but he was on the air for a long, long time and did these radio programs that could be picked up by small schools that had no kinds of resources. I think we did at one time play triangles and tambourines or something of that sort. We had no other organized activities. We went out for recess and played vigorously dodgeball and kickball and other things like that. I remember all of my grade school teachers very well. Ms. Hammond, Mrs. Rasmussen, Mr. Brennan. I remember that Mr. Brennan had us read passages from the Bible when we were in the 6th through 8th grades. Never thought about it seriously. We just picked something random. I must say that when I look back upon things, I can even visualize Ms. Hammond, my 1st, 2nd, and 3rd grade teacher, articulating words, and she was a great teacher. And this may sound inappropriate, but I just had the good fortune to be smart. Mm-hmm. So that in comparison to the other students in the school, and this was true in high school also, there wasn't any competition, which I think is unfortunate. But I was disadvantaged. My father worked for the railroad. My mother was a night telephone operator. The family was dysfunctional. My father was an alcoholic. But the one thing I remember vividly was that my father really had great respect for education, and I remember his taking me to the public library, and there was a public library in Hudson. We had to walk several miles to get there because we had no car. But I remember his taking me to the library, and I remember starting to read Nancy Drew and things of that sort. We had very few books in the house because we had no money. And it was, you know, something that was interesting to learn later on, how disadvantaged we really were. But everybody was disadvantaged, and so one was not cognizant of this particular thing. It wasn't until I went to college where I began to see people whose fathers were bankers, judges, doctors, lawyers, that I realized that, you know, there was a whole different kind of world out there. But I had a really good childhood. We lived out of town on about 20 acres of land, so we were kind of white trash, if you will. But the land that my parents lived on, because it was hilly and diverse and it was on a lake, I could walk through and see the change in the seasons and pick wildflowers and do just wonderful things. And I talked a lot to myself. I remember now that I would walk home from school and I would be talking to myself. There also were some really neat neighbors who took a shine to me, if you will. I remember a Swedish lady who baked sandbuckles, and she would always stop me on the way home and chat with me. And I guess I was really cute. I looked like Shirley Temple.
Oh.
And also, I must say that fortunately or unfortunately, I was, school was easy, but I was never challenged. But I do remember Miss Hannah in particular and her articulation of words and her teaching us reading and how to write and so forth.
Were you an only child?
No, I had a brother who is, have a brother who is almost 6 years younger. He unfortunately was challenged academically. I think he's dyslexic. It was not diagnosed at that time. He also had the disadvantage of coming after me. Mm-hmm. And so he never was able to whatever. And also he just never had any ambition to do anything. It was very frustrating. Now, of course, he says how much he wished he'd gone to school and all that, because he was very gifted mechanically and how great if he had trained to be a mechanic. Mm-hmm. But he didn't do that. In high school, the high school was relatively small. Our class was the smallest of any of them. And I participated in every extracurricular activity that there was. I was, you know, played basketball, softball, but I was hopelessly incompetent athletically, had no gift whatsoever, but I did it. And my mother had started me on piano lessons when I was in grade school. And I continued to take lessons, but I really didn't practice, and there was no motivation to do that. Somehow or other, she found an old piano, which she brought into our house, which took up almost the whole living room because the house was so tiny. But in high school, it was interesting that we got grades at mid-semester and then at the end of the semester, and the first half semester I was in the school, I was the only person who got straight A's. And that, of course, got the faculty's attention immediately. You know, I had no idea that this was a big deal. Huh. But it was, I guess. But it also kind of made things, in a way, good for me, because I got attention and there were expectations, and I participated in state speech contests. I have lots of medals for state speech contests. We used to actually drive all the way to Madison if we passed the district contest and come here to give our extemporaneous talks. Mm-hmm. I went to church. I went to the Presbyterian Church and I sang in the choir. I was a faithful attendee. And then in high school, were there any people who really influenced me?
Well, was there an assumption? I would think if you had the straight A's and people noticed you, there must have been an assumption early on that you were going to be going to college.
Yeah, there was no question about that. And the person who really helped to identify the school I went to was the Presbyterian pastor, Reverend Dr. Wright. And as a result of his influence, I went to a Presbyterian college that wasn't very far away, McAllister. Mm-hmm. I didn't really have any knowledge of the general world, my view was very, very limited. McAllister's, it was, now that I look back on it, extraordinary place. It was a liberal religious school, and although we had to attend chapel, and I sang in the choir, and I sang in the college choir, the whole choir, which did a radio performance every Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock on the state public radio station. And I also was in what was called Choral Readers, which was run by a professor of English, Mary Beth Owens, who had us read together. So we read various poetry, and she taught us how to enunciate and articulate, and it was an interesting experience also. But I was pretty much, a wallflower. I wasn't active socially or anything like that, and I clearly didn't have the economic wherewithal to be going off on skiing trips or this, that, and the other thing as other students could who were more amply endowed with financial resources. And I also felt an obligation to go home and try to take care of my family and clean the house and do things like that. And just that was the way it was, kind of parenting your parents because of the dysfunction, which wasn't, I thought everybody was dysfunctional. So I'm going on and on and on, no, but in, I think the person who was, I don't know, that there was one high school teacher, Miss Hughes, who taught mathematics, who was really one who pushed me. She actually had a part-time job working for the astronomy department at the University of Minnesota, and she used to go over there by bus, and she was always doing these calculations, and I'm not sure what she was calculating, but some kind of astronomical distances, mm-hmm. and I mean that literally, not figuratively, and she was always with a slide rule and her notebook and doing these calculations, because BC days was very, very different. I worked in the summer, I worked in the canning factory. I had therefore contact with immigrant workers and saw how they were mistreated. I did really mundane chores that they did, like take the cans and put them in boxes, but because I was quicker, I got promoted to box stitcher. So I would use this machine to staple the boxes together. But I saw how they couldn't use the facilities in Hudson. The canning factory was across the river in Minnesota, in Stillwater. It was Stokely Van Camp. Mm-hmm. But they were really excluded, and they lived in this horrible housing, and they moved back and forth from Wisconsin to Texas, close to Mexico where they lived. And there were Native Americans there, too, who were even lower class in terms of the way they were treated than the Hispanics who came. Had a girlfriend who got to work in the office because her father was in insurance and he had some contact with the company, but I didn't have that. Mm-hmm. I also worked for a lawyer one summer, taking care of his office, scrubbed his floors, did his things like that. And then I worked in St. Paul at the Tony Company, which made waving lotion.
Oh, sure.
And I actually did that during college, and then they were bought out by Gillette. And again, I witnessed what I felt to be ridiculously lax supervision of, you see I'm pretty hard-nosed, of employees, where the so-called scientists who were there just sat around and did nothing. But it was interesting because we measured the viscosity of waving lotion, and I got to see just something about how something was out there in the world. Mm-hmm. And when I was in college, I also, and I'm going into your
That's
second
okay.
question. I,
talk about your undergraduate
right,
work.
And I went to McAllister. That was an okay choice, but my decision to go into chemistry was not thought out. I think one of my science teachers in high school strongly recommended that I go into chemistry. I really wasn't thinking about what I was going to do with this. And I guess one of the reasons was stupid. that perhaps I wanted to go into a field where I could demonstrate that I could succeed in something that wasn't typical for success. Mm-hmm. Some of my high school classmates have told me that when I was 6 years old, that I don't remember this, I always said that I wanted to like be a lawyer or be something. Uh-huh. They thought I was kind of strange in that regard. For some reason, apparently, this kind of a desire was there. I'm not sure I was conscious of it. I think as I look back on this, one of the great desires is to get out of this environment where the chief avocation was getting drunk. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of helpless and hopeless sort of situation. And I don't know what was wrong, but I guess I was different. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that now in retrospect, but that's just the way I was put together. Whereas my brother barely made it through high school with D's, mm-hmm. and certainly was part of the Rod and Gun Club, and his biggest deal was going deer hunting. And how did we get to be so different when mm-hmm. we were in the same environment? Mm-hmm. Of course, if he was dyslexic or is dyslexic, this certainly could have impacted greatly on his ability to perform in school. But anyway, it's an unusual thing. My education was financed theoretically by my parents, but after I graduated, I found out that my mother had never paid the tuition. And so she paid some of it, but uh-huh. not all of it. And of course, tuitions weren't what they are now. And I went to get my transcript, and I couldn't get a transcript because I still had bills. So I paid off my bills and never said one word to her about this. But this was typical of my mother, who always owed somebody something. She was just...
Did you live on campus then when you were...
Yes, couple of years I didn't live on campus. I lived in a house that was close to the campus, very close walking distance. And that was a nice thing because there was a young woman living in a house close by. She was living in the home of her aunt and uncle. And we became very good friends as we walked back and forth to school. Margaret Anderson left McAllister at the end of her second year go to the University of Minnesota because of financial reasons. Mm-hmm. But she and I still are in contact, and she lives in Edina, Minnesota, and we see one another from time to time, and it's kind of like picking up
sure.
where you were before. But she was the closest person I had. I had another couple of close friends in college. One was a roommate, who scandalized the school by falling in love with the choir director, who was a divorced man, and he had to resign from his position because of the relationship with her. And so there's just all sorts of crazy things that existed then. But the school, some of the teachers were terrible. My chemistry teachers, by and large, were horrible when I look back upon their teaching techniques and so forth. But the professors I had in other subjects, like English and political science and psychology and so forth, were outstanding. Walter Mondale's wife was one of my classmates.
Oh.
Joan had gone to Summit School, which mm-hmm. is a private school on Summit Avenue in St. Paul. Her father was J. Maxwell Adams, was the college chaplain. And a very prominent figure on campus, her husband Walter went to McAllister very briefly, but he had to leave because his father died, and his father was a pastor in southern Minnesota, I think, so he had to leave because of financial reasons. Yes, ma'am. Sure. I'm sorry.
Okay. So, well, you said you majored in chemistry. Did you have any idea when you did that what you were going to do with that chemistry?
Well, the
degree?
Expectation was that I would go to graduate school because,
okay.
again, I got good grades.
Mm-hmm.
No thinking about career. Mm-hmm. Just as it was before, you get good grades, so you go on to college. You get good grades, so you go on to graduate school. And the chemistry major decision was something I would not redo. But again, I think I was trying to prove something to myself, and I didn't even know consciously that I was trying to prove something to myself, that it was more difficult to get a degree in chemistry than it was in biology, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So again, my graduate school decision was influenced by the chair of this small chemistry department in the school, and it was not a good decision in retrospect. But he had had a student who went there.
Which is?
McAllister.
Oh, I see.
Iowa State.
Oh, Iowa State, okay.
Yeah, and she had done exceptionally well, and so he was pushing all the undergraduates to go to graduate school there, and I could get a teaching assistant and get my pay. I never got a master's degree, because in the sciences, master's degrees are usually reserved for those people who can't get a PhD, except in some universities where a master's degree is part of the process. One of our sons has a PhD in physics, and they give them a master's degree when they pass their prelims or their qualifying exams.
Mm-hmm.
It's just all depends. But most of the schools don't give master's degrees except for consolation prizes.
I see.
When it's chemistry, physics, and so forth.
Sure.
Or even the biochemistry, stuff like that. So I think one of the things that was most influential in college
mm-hmm.
was an instructor I had in the second year in analytical chemistry who told me, this was a man who was really not a professor, he was an instructor, because he was also doing something at the University of Minnesota, so he was doing part-time teaching, told me categorically that women belonged in science only as science librarians. So that was a great stimulus to me.
Oh yeah.
Nobody else ever conveyed that sort of an attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But
were there other women in your chemistry classes?
No,
when you,
no. There weren't women when I was in graduate school either.
Ah.
This has its advantages and disadvantages, because people knew you. I remember taking a final exam in statistical thermodynamics, and the professor said I was the only girl. Well, you wouldn't call them girls now, you'd call them women. Well, June recommended these questions. We had three questions on the exam. That went over like a lead balloon, that, you know, I had kind of talked to him and suggested these were the kind of things. But again, I was not taken seriously. I always had this feeling that, yeah, it was okay to give her a degree, but I remember during my final oral that one of the professors asked me, how's this going to help you in the kitchen? The funny thing is, except for the guy who told me that women only belonged in libraries in the science field, I was really insensitive in a way to these kinds of slurs, because there wasn't a women's movement yet.
Sure.
And so I was not thinking about any kind of overt, covert, discriminatory activities.
Mm-hmm.
But I must say that as far as college and graduate school are concerned, I never felt really discriminated against in any way. But I realized in retrospect that they didn't expect much of me.
Oh.
You know, they give me a degree, but so that was it. And in fact, when I finished my PhD, by that time I had decided to marry. And my husband had the potential to get a job with one of the oil companies as a research chemist. And they would have, even way back then, they would have accommodated me.
Mm-hmm.
They would have found something for me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time also there were some instructor positions available in women's colleges in the East. I did not consider those because of the fact that my husband was the preeminent person. I come from a blue-collar family, so women work, but they do everything else as well. That's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So when my husband was offered a position here, and there were lots of positions open at that point in time, it was the heyday of science in terms of the funding and the opportunities. There's still great opportunities, but it's tougher now.
That was in the early 50s then, or mid-50s probably by that time.
Late
50s. Late
50s, mm-hmm. early 60s. Anyway, so he came to Wisconsin, and then I never even asked the question of what am I going to be doing. The idea was that I would do everything I could to support him in his career, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
I helped edit his papers, I did this, I relieved him of all responsibility for anything. And he's been very successful. He created a field, he's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, he's well known throughout the world. But I really did make a lot of things easy for him.
Sure.
Now the odd thing is that he didn't demand that. In fact, he was the one who was constantly pushing me because I was very reticent. I didn't feel as good as guys who were in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
I felt inadequate. And in many ways, I was poorly prepared. I don't think my undergraduate training was good. I don't think I had rigorous training as a graduate student, and then I didn't do a postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
So I did none of the things which are essential for success in science.
Mm-hmm.
And also, now, I question whether I really have science is the thing that turns me on. And
mm-hmm.
I love science. I like the scientific method. I think it's been enormously valuable from an educational standpoint. But from what really gives me joy, I don't think standing at the lab bench doing experiments or even supervising other people's experiments are things that give me joy. Now, that could be due to the fact that I have lousy training.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you have appropriate education, and this is in the broadest sense, unless you have good mentoring, you aren't prepared to do good science.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I'm capable.
Mm-hmm. What about your teaching experience in graduate school? Was that a positive?
I taught in undergrad school, too.
Mm-hmm.
I did chemistry laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
I taught nurses.
Oh,
God. The nurses used to come to McAllister from three nursing schools in the Twin Cities to take basic chemistry. Oh, man. They were really challenging.
Huh.
The nurses I know now are extraordinary because I run with this cadre of nurses who are leaders in the country. But basically, these young women were pretty stupid and they didn't have much common sense. But that's when I started teaching. And so I taught lab.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the room being full of hydrogen sulfide because we had no hoods. And of course, the good thing is that H2S smells at one part per gazillion, whereas cyanide does not. But and then when I went to graduate school, I taught because that's what I got, a teaching assistantship.
Right.
So I taught freshman chemistry, and I really enjoyed that. It was challenging because
mm-hmm.
Some of the students we had were great, and some of them were pretty dismal. And the instructors who were really teaching the courses, some of them were quite interesting, but that's a whole other subject in itself. So I did teach during both undergraduate and graduate school. I did that.
Iowa State is in Iowa City?
No, it's in Ames.
Ames, that's
in
right.
In the middle of the
That's right,
current
Ames.
Fields.
What was it like living in Ames?
Hot, horribly hot and muggy in the summer. I was really so focused on school that I didn't pay much attention to the lack of cultural whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Ames now has one of the finest auditoriums in the world
mm-hmm.
for concerts. Symphony orchestras go there and say that the acoustics are special, very special. So they built, some family gave money and they built this thing. It was also the headquarters of the Ames Laboratory, in, which was part of what was then called the Atomic Energy Commission and is now called the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And it was at Iowa State that the rare earths were separated, and there are a lot of people who were involved in some pretty high-powered research that led to the development of fuels for some of the horrible weapons, now we call them weapons of mass destruction, that are available. So the Ames Laboratory of the Atomic Energy Commission had some pretty unique features in terms of its, especially with rare earths, which people rarely even learn the symbols for because they're a special group of substances. But there were still residues of that research. There would be parts in the chemistry building where over in the corner would be this huge glass cylinder that stretched about four floors and was full of ion exchange resin. And this had been used to separate these elements from one another, or you separated compounds containing the elements. So it was interesting from that standpoint. So I got some idea. I also had an interesting experience in graduate school in that I wanted to, I had the opportunity to get a research fellowship so I didn't have to continue to teach and could focus on my research. And this required that I would get security clearance so I could go into these laboratories where there was secret material and where some classified research was done. And I just didn't get clearance. And my husband-to-be was talking with his major professor one day, and his major professor said, I don't know if you want to be hanging out with that woman. She's a communist.
Oh my
and
God.
He said, well, why is that? Well, you know, she didn't get clearance because her background is questionable. So I demanded to have my file, my case opened again, and it was. And I met with these two FBI agents with a tape recorder in this room without any windows with a stack this tall of my files. Just remember, we're talking about how things were, and maybe, and even worse now, of course, potentially. Don't get me on the current administration. But anyway, it turns out when I was in high school, I debated. One of the questions was, should China be admitted to the United Nations? And because small towns don't have any entertainment, they would have the debate team come and talk to the Rotary Club, the Elks Club, the this club, the that club. So our debate team went and talked, and sometimes you talk for and sometimes you talked against a question. That's what debate is about. Well, when the FBI went to my small town to interview people about me to get Q clearance, there was questions about my loyalty. After all, I had supported admission of China to the United Nations. So I was viewed as a radical communist by some people in this small community. Well, by the time we got done with our interview with these two FBI agents, we were all laughing. But I did get clearance, and I did get admission to this lab because that's where my major professor had his major research laboratories. One of the things about this that was serious is, of course, at that point I was solely focused on my husband's career, was that if I had had this questionable history, which was not cleared, he went to get federal grants and they found that he was married to this radical communist traitor
16-year-old.
That he might, there might be questions. We didn't know how the McCarthy era would end. So anyway, that was one thing. When I was in graduate school, we would go to the union to watch the hearings on the television. I don't think many of us at that time really understood the historical significance of that, the same as I was here in 69 for the demonstrations against the Vietnam War and routinely came in every morning where there were busloads of National Guardsmen stationed at Camp Randall, and then they came out and lined the streets and the students marched down here, because I was actually in this building way back then in a laboratory down on the third floor, and over in this section. And my husband, who is in the chemistry department, many times his graduate students were exposed to tear gas because they weren't involved in any demonstrations. They were just trying to get to school.
Sure.
They were trying to get to the lab to work.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, his graduate students were, one of them spent a lot of time thinking about leaving for Canada because he was so dismayed. He's now, and has been for some time, Vice Chancellor of Arizona State University, and has had many high first faculty positions, but then administrative positions in academic science in this country. So it's intriguing when I look back upon how these things happened. And then we had also, my husband had a graduate student who went back to Saigon and was professor at what is now in Ho Chi Minh City, and was one of the last to get out of Vietnam before they closed everything down. So in the context of, we can't live in this country or in this world without having our lives affected by these very significant international, national events, but sometimes they come very close to home. And you know, the war at home, which was focused in Madison, was really an incredible experience. And watching, you know, the police clash with students and the guards chase the students up the street, remembering the banners, I just wish people would take to the streets again.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's off the subject of what you want to do. Why did I come to the university? I came because my husband got a job and I came with him.
And that was right after graduate school?
Yep, I didn't have a postdoc. He was ready to be hired. I tried to get a job with Rayovac. There weren't many places to go. I went to the Forest Products Laboratory. I went to Rayovac. They had no interest in me. I had a PhD in physical chemistry, and my research had been on the surface tension of molten salts. My research background didn't fit into anything. The chemistry department, which employed my husband, offered me essentially a position as a TA, that is what they give to people who are coming in to work on their PhDs. And then there was an ad for a postdoc in the Department of Pharmacology. And even though I wasn't qualified, because I didn't have any background in biochemistry, I was hired because I think the faculty member who hired me was pretty desperate. He had been looking, seriously, he had been looking for people and he couldn't find anybody. So I was brought on as a postdoc, and I spent many years being a professional mistress to department faculty members or chairs. So that man left and went to Brown University. And then Jack Strominger came. But it was at that time that, in fact, the whole Department of Pharmacology left and went to the University of Minnesota. Dr. Scheidemann was the chair of this department. It was there was no molecular biology. It was really a physiological pharmacology department at that point in time. He got mad at the dean of the medical school about some issues about teaching pharmacists, which he didn't want to have anything to do with teaching pharmacists because the requirements were that there had to be a laboratory. So he and the dean could not ever resolve this conflict. And so Scheidemann picked himself up and he went to Minnesota with almost all of his faculty, except for one. That one person was the person who had hired me to work in his lab. So the department went. The school is left with this dilemma that they have to teach medical students and they don't have anybody to teach because there's Bob Parks by himself. And so, and he had a couple of MDs who could do a little teaching. So anyway, he turned to me to see if I could teach something. And I could teach acid-base balance and diuretics because this is really based on physical chemistry, so I could teach a little bit. And then I taught a little more and a little more because they were desperate. Then Bob left and went to Brown. And Jack Strominger came, who is the person who discovered the mechanism of action of penicillin. And this was a stop-off point for him because he really wanted to go to Harvard, where he still is, mm-hmm. and is doing fabulously. He just celebrated his 80th birthday with a big, big party. He has a stable of graduate students and postdocs, 16 to 20 people work in his group. Really dynamic guy. Anyway, so he came and he really didn't give diddly squat about teaching and created this crazy pharmacology course for first year students that didn't cover any of the subjects of pharmacology. But because he was kind of desperate for teachers, he asked me to teach something. Then he left and went to Harvard, where he'd always wanted to go, as I said. And then Lowell Hoken came from the Department of Physiological Chemistry, now called Biomolecular Chemistry, to chair the department because they didn't have any money to recruit for outside. And here I was sitting here, and he hired me to be kind of a lab person.
Now, what year would that have been, approximately?
What year did Jack leave? Probably in the late 60s, okay. 1968 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And again, he had a course to teach. Mm-hmm. And then the curriculum was undergoing revision. So here was a body, and also in that interim, I did do some teaching in chemistry. I was a temporary part-time, very clear, temporary part-time instructor in the Department of Chemistry. I taught freshman chemistry. I taught analytical chemistry in the second year. And I went to a faculty meeting, and one of the professors said, "Wow, we've never had a woman here." But anyway, it was clear I was temporary part-time.
I see.
So I had these two half-time jobs, half-time teaching chemistry, half-time kind of working on Bob Parks's, this was before Strelinger came, Bob Parks's research group, because Bob decided to go off to here, there, and everywhere, and his graduate students were kind of left up in the air. So I helped to write their theses and, you know, did some of the mundane things. That's why I say, in a sense, you could describe that as being a professional mistress. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I've always been here.
But you're a full professor now.
Yep.
How did that happen?
Well, I was never formally hired. Okay. We went on a, it could never happen now. I was not qualified. We went, my husband got a Guggenheim, and we went to Munich for his Guggenheim experience because he'd had a lot of collaborations with professors in Germany. It was 1970. We left during the height of the Vietnam garbage. Mm-hmm. And we had three children then, and we lived in a second floor apartment, or maybe it was third floor. And it was a struggle because of the way washing is done with German washing machines, where it's not timed, but it depends on the heat of the water.
Oh.
The cycles depend on how hot the water is. That determines the time. There were no dryers.
And what city were you in?
Munich.
You were in Munich.
We were outside in a small village.
I see.
But anyway, it was an interesting experience. And during that time, I began to think, holy cow, I don't think I could be a Hausfrau. And then I started to think about, what do I want to be when I grow up? So I came back to Madison and said to, by that time Lowell Hoken was chair of the department, said to Lowell, I had just learned that the wife of a faculty member in the Department of Medicine had gotten an appointment in the pharmacology department. And I thought, why in the heck is she getting an appointment? I think I'm as reasonably good as her, but so I went to him and said, could I be considered to be a part-time assistant professor? I could not work 80 hours a week. Mm-hmm. I could not. Mm-hmm. Not with three kids and a husband who worked 80 hours a week. And he said, well, I'll talk to the faculty tomorrow. There weren't very many faculty. And they said, sure. So I became a half-time assistant professor. And that's how it all started. I had no field, no postdoc. Starting from a blank slate, if you will, So I thought, what am I going to do? Well, I'd been teaching. By that time, I got into teaching drugs that affect the central nervous system, and I'd been reading about pain and other things, and I thought, well, maybe I'll look at some things related to the mechanism of action of morphine or analgesia that's produced by non-drug methods like stress-induced analgesia. I don't quite know how I got into all of this. And I actually did write a grant and got funding from the National Institute of Drug Abuse. No, it was a terrible grant. But things were really, money was really available. There was lots of money. It was the golden age.
Uh-huh.
And so crappy grant proposals got funded. Boy, no more. Mm-hmm. No more. Hmm. Really a tough world out there. So I got this money, and then at the same time, the Department of Pharmacology and the School of Pharmacy had written this joint grant to support graduate students. And lo and behold, two of those graduate students came to work with me, even though we really, none of us knew what I was doing. Well, one of them's a professor of biochemistry at LSU, unfortunately. I don't know what's going to happen to her laboratory. She's been quoted many times in Science about the devastation of Katrina and effect on science in New Orleans. But anyway, so I had these two graduate students. I've never had any since then. But that was the time when I really did do science. And Molly Carnes, who's very prominent on campus, actually, when she first came to Wisconsin, did science in my lab. Extraordinary when I look back at that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was a tough time, and really it was because I didn't know what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I just didn't have the skills, the technical skills and know-how. I hadn't any time to sit back and reflect, to develop ideas, anybody to really fly them by.
Mm-hmm.
But the students did manage to So I'm answering a lot of your questions mm-hmm. as we go along because I've read them in advance, but I'm just doing this sort of chronologically. So that was about 1973, I think it was, when I asked, could I be a part-time assistant professor in the department, and said yes. So then came the time for me to get tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And things were pretty, I think, lax then, too.
But you were still part-time, right?
I was still part-time. Oh, wow. I never would have given myself tenure, I can tell you that. I am hard-nosed. But somehow or other, I slipped through. There was only one problem, and that was that I was part-time. And the university had never given anybody tenure part-time.
Oh.
But I really need to go back to what was the real stimulus for my asking if I could be a part-time assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, my husband was up in the graduate school talking to Bob Bach and other people, and talking about his wife and how she didn't have a position, and he understood there were rules against husband and wife being on the faculty, and he couldn't understand how this pair, who were named Bach, and he was a prominent person in immunology, how they could get dual appointments, but somehow or other there was supposed to be a rule against it, and somebody laughed and said, we just say that to keep the women out of our hair. You know, something like that.
Yeah.
Big joke. And that really was what set me up saying, well, this is a bunch of crap, so I'm going to ask the department. I forgot that little thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's serendipity.
Mm-hmm.
So everything in my life has kind of been serendipity. It's like that jerk when I was a sophomore in college who said women only belong in science if they are science librarians. So anyway, in 1977, a significant event occurred. Now, during this time also, I was teaching more and more because they didn't have faculty to teach. They just kind of, you know, there would be a subject and nobody to teach it. And so they'd say, can you do this? So, like, I remember when I had to teach antiarrhythmics. I hardly knew where the heart was. But I learned, it takes, you know, if you just focus, a couple of weeks, I not only knew where the heart was, but I knew the genesis of cardiac arrhythmias, and I learned the drugs sufficiently to teach the students. And actually, it's an advantage to be dumb, because then you really get to understand what you have to say in order to make people understand, because you went through this process in trying to understand yourself. Sure. So there's advantages to being ill-informed.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1977, I was appointed by the governor of the state of Wisconsin to the Controlled Substances Board, the state's drug regulatory authority. That was really a significant event. Why was I appointed?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because the legislature, when they created the Controlled Substances Act, the state of Wisconsin, which was then Chapter 161 of the statutes, I don't know what chapter it is now, said that there were all these people should be on the board representing state agencies, but there needed to be two governor's appointees. One was a psychiatrist, and one was a pharmacologist. That's not a pharmacist,
mm-hmm.
That's a pharmacologist. The guy who helped to write the Controlled Substances Act was a professor of medicine. He just died within the last year, Joe Benferrato.
Oh, sure.
Joe ran Rebos, the detox center for alcoholics. Joe was the first appointee as the pharmacologist because he had helped to create the board. And he and I had been teaching together in a course, and I had suddenly begun teaching drug abuse. God only knows why, because somebody needed somebody to teach drug abuse, and they asked me if I would do it, and I said, sure. So he said, well, if I look around at the faculty, all the rest of the faculty in the Department of Pharmacology only do science and only know basic science. And then things were becoming more and more molecular. So you seem to me the only person who has some knowledge of what goes on in the real world in the field of drugs. So he recommended me, and I was appointed. And I served on that board until I just couldn't take the time anymore, until the state had wrecked the board by moving it from the Department of Health and Family Services into the Department of Regulation and Licensing and taking away its staffing. But anyway, in the context of that board, is where I began to work on the things I work on today. So it was all serendipity. I still was working in the lab then. I continued to work for a long time. I was doing a collaboration with somebody in the Department of Anatomy, and that's where the money came from to be able to do the research. I really didn't make an effort to get grants on my own to do science, because I knew I didn't have the resume that would qualify, and I didn't have the time to get the data. I would have had to take a sabbatical or something mm-hmm. like that. So the Controlled Substances Board was an interesting experience. There was a very wonderfully dynamic, capable, able staff to the board. And board success or failure depend on the quality of the staff, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he and I teamed up, and we did a lot of projects together that really related to abuse of prescription drugs. And there was also a conference on cocaine, which I had little to do with. But it was that board experience that led us to consider a law introduced in 1984 in the Congress to legalize heroin. And I knew enough pharmacology to know that that was just a red herring, that heroin is converted into the body to morphine. And the reason why pain was poorly treated was not because we didn't have drugs, but because they weren't being used appropriately. And out of that, in 1984 and 1985, and then formally in 1986, was created the Wisconsin Cancer Pain Initiative. And I've been working in that area ever since, doing different kinds of things. First starting out just here in the state, and then expanding so other states had similar organizations, then moving to look more broadly at issues like we had done a lot of education, and it was clear that education doesn't change the way that people practice. And I felt that you got to give them some carrots, but you have to give them a stick.
So you were educating medical people, doctors, nurses?
Yeah, primarily nurses. Physicians in the beginning, and also nurses, mm-hmm. and some pharmacists. Mm-hmm. But then I said, we got to get a stick in, and I went to some pain summit, and I chaired a subgroup at that meeting, which is trying to figure out how to change physician practice. And I concluded that, and that was 1996 by that point in time, there'd been a lot of things going on, or 1995, no, it was 96. And I said, I think what we need to do is have standards so that there are requirements that pain has to be managed, has to be assessed and treated. And I said, I'll approach the Joint Commission. I didn't know what I was talking about, but that's all right. That was in September. In October, the Joint Commission came to do their survey of UW Hospital and clinics. Because I'd been involved at the local level with the pain team at UW Hospital, I went to the presentation that one of our great, great, great nurses had made to show the kind of program that had been developed at UW Hospital and Clinics to assess pain, to manage it as appropriately as possible. It isn't all succeeded yet, but UW was way ahead. And at the break, I went up to one of the surveyors. You're not supposed to do that. But I went and talked to him and said, wouldn't it be wonderful if every hospital in the United States had a program, had a commitment as UW does? He said, I agree. My daughter died of breast cancer just a few weeks ago, and she died in horrible pain, and it shouldn't happen. He said, I'll have somebody call you. On Monday, somebody called me from the Joint Commission. I didn't know that people from the American Pain Society and other folks had been trying to break into the Joint Commission and get them to pay attention to this. And then, somehow or other, I got hooked up with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation because, gosh, what's her name? There was a person who used to be here who became an important staff person at Robert Wood Johnson. But anyway, I got talking with them, and they said, look, if you can get the Joint Commission to agree to work on this project, we'll fund it. In fact, they'd already funded us in a previous iteration to to have a project to grow state pain initiatives. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not quite sure where, I can't remember quite the history of where I hooked up with them, but I hooked up with Lou Sandy, who's no longer with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. But anyway, with them, you kind of dialogue for a long time. You have to court them, and you have to do all sorts of negotiations. But anyway, I got with this wonderful staff person who said, if you can get the Joint Commission to agree, we'll fund this. So I wrote a proposal. I took it to the commissioners of the Joint Commission in June, and that was to allow us to work on a project to put pain assessment and management into the standards that they use to accredit the nation's healthcare facilities. The Joint Commission commissioner said, no, can't do that. It's okay if you write standards to take care of people at the end of life, but that's it. So by that time, I'd made a great acquaintance with one of the members of the standards department, Carol Patterson, and she was really committed to this on a personal level. She said, we'll do pain in the dying newborn, we'll do pain in the dying this, we'll do pain in the dying that, we'll just move ahead. So in September, we started the process of working with the standards department, and you have to go through a bunch of processes. You have to create a documentation of the need for the standards. Then you have to go to various professional technical committees, like there's a hospital PTAC, a long-term care PTAC, a this PTAC, and a that PTAC. You have to convince them that this is okay. And then you write the standards, and then they go through these committees again, and then they go out in the field for testing and all of this. And we did it in 2 years.
And you did that without funding, or had
no.
You got
we got
the funding then from
and the smart
okay.
thing. Oh yeah, we got a $1.6 million grant.
Oh my!
And by then, Robert Wood Johnson's really smart. They said, you ask for money to pay for a staff person at the Joint Commission, because if we're paying for staff, they're always saying they don't have enough money. Then you know, they're so smart,
sure.
And I didn't think of that. But anyway, the first committee we went to was the hospital committee. And I remember going down to the palace of the Joint Commission outside of Chicago. And lo and behold, Mike Miller, who was head of New Start here in Madison, mm-hmm. was chair of that hospital PTAC.
Oh my goodness.
I didn't know. Well, it turned out he was absolutely opposed to this. So he recused, he said, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? He recused himself from the chair so that he could speak against it. And we went around the commissioners, or the members of the committee, and the Dennis O'Leary, the head of Joint Commission, was there, as were a couple of other critical people. So the proposal was presented, not by me, because I wasn't an official part of Joint Commission, but by one of the staff people with whom we closely worked. And of course, the people had the documentation in front of them in their big book. I have some of the books, in fact, saved. And various people spoke against this. Some spoke for it. One guy said, look, we don't need standards. We assess patient satisfaction, and that is all we need to do. If they're satisfied, fine. Well, I wasn't supposed to talk, but I could not keep my mouth shut. So from the peanut gallery, I said, sir, I have to respectfully disagree, because there's study after study that shows that patients are well satisfied with their pain management, even if their mean pain score is 7 out of 10 on a 0 to 10 scale, which means they have severe pain, because their expectations are low, mm-hmm. etc. Patient satisfaction has been studied with regard to a variety of indicators of quality of care. The only thing that it's valid for is the quality of the food.
Hmm.
Nothing else correlates with patient satisfaction. Doesn't tell you anything. And so anyway, ultimately this committee said no. But there was a guy sitting behind me who was an alternate member of this PTAC. He sends me a note on a little scrip of paper. I still have it. It says, hang in there.
Huh.
So then the next thing was to go to the long-term care committee. And they said, resoundingly, yes. The next committee we went to was home health. Yes. The next committee was, I don't know what, yes. So there was a resounding yes. So we ignored the hospital PTAC and went ahead, and I had this wonderful colleague who'd been a surveyor who came and really went and helped to develop these standards. But they didn't come out of thin air, because prior to that, we'd written a manual called Building an Institutional Commitment to Pain Management. This isn't the manual, it's someplace. Mm-hmm. It was a big spiral-bound book to help mm-hmm. healthcare facilities develop a program to manage pain appropriately. But anyway, so the standards got written, and again, they went out in the field for testing, and some changes were made, and in June of 1999, we started this in the fall of 1997, the commissioners of the Joint Commission said yes. They approved the standards.
And the hospital standards were included?
I'll get to that.
All right.
The standards for all facilities.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the commissioners forgot that they told us we couldn't write standards except for people dying.
Right.
And I saw Mike Miller later on, and he said to me, I thought we told you no.
Uh-huh.
I said, yeah, you did, but we just went ahead, and it seems like it worked out okay. So, anyway, that was the story of the Joint Commission standards. And it hasn't changed the face of pain management yet.
So when were the standards?
They began to be scored for compliance in January of 2001.
So how many years did that take?
It took from the fall of 97 to June of 99 to get the standards. But then the Joint Commission commissioner said, people aren't ready for this. Mm-hmm. We have to give them a little time, and we agreed.
Sure.
So,
sure.
But now we recognize that people are assessing pain. They are documenting the assessment, and they don't know what to do. So the next phase of our work, and I just got a grant from the Mayday Fund, is we're writing another version of our manual that will provide guidance to people as to how to deal with specific pain problems. And we're going to use the nurse as the target for these educational interventions, because nurses are really key to putting policies and procedures in place to getting appropriate pain management strategies. Physicians just don't get involved in these kinds of quality improvement efforts. It's not something they care about.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so where's my...
Well, I think we were at tenure. Did you earn tenure here?
Yes, I earned tenure. Okay. Actually, when my husband and I went to China with a delegation in 1979, and I got tenure as a part-time assistant professor.
Okay.
The culture of the department, that kind of question is really hard to answer because, this is a very interesting department, and I don't think it's relevant to me.
Okay, well, and in the beginning you said it just about changed completely, right? At one point when everybody left?
Yeah, but then what happened is we got a new chair after, when Lowell Hogan was chair, there was a small group of faculty, very small, and they really didn't want to change. They were intransigent. And then Arnie Rojo became chair, and he has really built the department. He's brought in great researchers,
mm-hmm.
who are bringing in lots of federal dollars, which is one measure of success. The culture of the department is hard to explain. It's not relevant to me. Collaborative work is encouraged among members of the department, all
mm-hmm.
of whom are scientists. Some of them write grants together, publish papers together. There's a great... Arnie is a really dedicated chair. He's one of these totally unselfish individuals. They are a rare beast.
Right.
But he always thinks the department first and himself second.
That's good.
So there's a lot of collaboration. I've taught courses.
Yeah, you've talked a lot.
A lot of medical school, but I also always taught in something called People, Chemicals, and the Environment. And it was once called Man, Chemicals, and the Environment. My late son said to me, Mother, how can you allow a course to be named Man, Chemicals, and the Environment? So it got changed to People. How many students have I mentored? My teaching has changed because the medical school teaching has changed. The expectations of the students have changed. The curriculum has changed. We could talk about that for hours, because I don't think any of us really understands how to teach medical students effectively now.
Mm.
I think, there's been a change, because these are students who are raised on 30-second sound bites, who expect instant kind of things. It's a very different world out there, and we could talk long and long about education today.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't easy. It really isn't easy. Students don't go to lectures. They want everything spoon-fed. And I think the administration, in a way, encourages spoon-feeding. There is so much information overload for these poor people. Nobody stepped back and said, what does a second-year medical student really need to know?
Mm-hmm.
Who do I mentor? Well, one of the fun things is that there have been all these medical students, and I will go out to give a talk in a small hospital, and someone will come up and say, hi, do you remember me? And I remember something you said, and it's always been a part of my practice. This is a really wonderful thing when a doc comes up and says, you made a difference in my life. So those kinds of things stand there. The students that I had as graduate students, there were only two of them. And one of them, Iris Lindberg, has been extraordinarily successful and is a professor of biochemistry. But her future is really in doubt because the labs were destroyed.
All of her materials
were destroyed in Katrina. Freezers and freezers full of cells that she'd specially developed.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know what's... She hasn't answered my emails recently, so I don't know what's going on.
Hmm.
My current work is funded by primarily private things.
What's the May Day? You said the May Day Fund.
May Day is a family that decided to honor their mother by spending her legacy in supporting pain-related activities.
Oh, okay.
So In 1986, I'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 1990s, after being involved in all these educational activities, I, and along with a lot of other people, wasn't original with me, said, education alone doesn't change practice. Let's help people change practice by giving them a cookbook. This is how you do it. And so this is the manual. And this was paid for by a grant I wrote to Mayday in 1996. Mm. Small amount of money, $30,000. This is the second edition. But I've always had the most incredible colleagues to work with me. I've just been blessed with the kinds of folks who come out of the woodwork and say, sure, I'd like to work on this. So Mayday is this family that really gives these funds to relatively small projects, mm-hmm. because the current money we got was just $79,000 to create the next version of this manual, which will move beyond just this is how you get the procedures in place, but this is how you manage pain effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So Mayday is this family, and they've been very generous, and they've had a major impact. Other sources of funding have Robert Wood Johnson's given us 5 or 6 grants, which is pretty unusual. First, a grant to get pain initiatives formed in other states and to help them grow. Then the standards grant. Then they gave a grant, again, focused on enhancing the work of the state pain initiatives. Then they gave us a grant to help enhance our collaboration with the American Cancer Society. And then they gave us a grant to work on some projects with states to improve the laws and regulations with govern the prescribing of controlled substances.
Now, where would you rank Wisconsin then among the other states in terms of the pain initiative and what you're doing here?
Well, our pain initiative, interestingly, flourished greatly beginning in 1987. I mean, we're 20 years old, mm-hmm. but we're not formally organized as other states are, because in fact, so much has been done that the question is, what does an organization really, would creating an organization and having meetings mean anything? We're evaluating mm-hmm. that right now. We're doing some things that are sort of models. We're working with on a project to translate some assessment tools into the Hmong language. Mm-hmm. We're going up to Wausau on the 21st to talk with the people there to see if we can test the utility of these tools in assessing pain and depression in their Hmong patient population. We just did a survey of Wisconsin managed care organizations to try to see what they pay for in the pain arena, because mm-hmm. one of the big challenges today is access.
Mm-hmm.
It's access to providers, but it's also access to the money to sure. pay for. I was just at a conference in Rockford, that's not in Wisconsin, of course, last Wednesday, and many people were talking about the fact that although there's evidence for the benefit of acupuncture in certain kinds of pain, there's no money mm-hmm. to pay for it. We've moved from focusing just on cancer to focusing on pain broadly, because we did, with money from Robert Wood Johnson, a project nationwide with 235 hospitals to try to improve the management of post-operative pain.
Oh.
And we've done projects in 9 or 10 states with state pain initiatives focused on small healthcare facilities, long-term care facilities, home health, and hospitals, to not only educate them, but also to get them to change the practice in their setting.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing more of those. And we've done videos to teach nurses. These are 7 videos that needs to be updated. Teaching nurses some basics about pain. Each one is about 10, 12 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
We've written patient education materials. I don't know exactly where this money came from. Medtronic Foundation gave us money for this.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of our money now that RWJ is no longer focused on pain and palliative care, it has to come from industry. We just got a nice grant from the Lance Armstrong Foundation, 3 years of funding. We are reaching out to the Susan G. Komen Foundation. Mm-hmm. I've been having conversations, and we sent them a bunch of material, and I hope we can go to Texas to sit and commiserate about the way they can help us with our things.
Sure.
So the funding comes from a diversity of sources, but we were blessed that Robert Wood Johnson gave us this hunk of money that really made a difference in our ability to work.
Mm-hmm.
We've also were blessed that Purdue Pharma gave us a significant amount of money to keep things operational here. Purdue Pharma has fallen on hard times, first because their product OxyContin has been abused,
mm-hmm.
but more importantly because they lost a lawsuit that another drug company brought against them, accusing them of stealing patents or things like that. Now that's a confusing thing because first the court ruled in favor of the company that was suing Purdue Pharma. Then subsequently another court reversed that decision. And now it's again under investigation and we don't know which will win. But mm-hmm. I can tell you that the consequences of these lawsuits are very, very significant. Purdue had to lay off, when it lost the lawsuit initially, about 3/4 of its staff.
Oh my.
If the company that originally sued them loses this next round, they may go under because Purdue will undoubtedly sue them for billions for, you know, the damage that this suit caused.
Hmm. Now what company is that?
Endo Pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the funding is a constant problem, and what we're trying to do is to get more diverse funding, and I don't know how to do that. Everywhere I go, I ask, do you have $5 million?
I don't. Sorry.
Well, out of here. The most significant developments in the field, again, this would take a long time to explain, mm-hmm. because the last 15 to 20 years has seen an incredible a series of advances in the science and medicine of pain. And there's just many, many elements that have come into play. My involvement in Faculty Governments Committee work...
But just, can we back up? What do you consider to be your most important contribution to the field? I mean, I can see a lot of it right here, but what would you point to?
I've really just been a catalyst. I bring people together to do things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think serving as a catalyst for action is what I've done.
Okay.
I guess a major commitment that I've always had in this field is to make sure that we are scrupulously accurate. This is a field that is filled with misinformation, hyperbole. People are fearful about addiction when they use certain medicines for pain control. There's an exaggeration of things, a misunderstanding of a lot of things. And so I guess one of the things that I've always stressed is that it's essential to be extraordinarily careful and accurate. And anything you say has to be based by the best facts you can find.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that insistence on that kind of standard. But basically, all I've done is to bring people together to do things.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Still trying to really motivate the American Cancer Society to.
Now I have to ask, are you still part-time? It doesn't sound that way.
Oh, I haven't been part-time since, when did I go full-time? Jeez, whiz. Probably in the early 80s I began to work full-time.
And is full-time 80 hours a week over the course of a year? Probably, huh?
Well, I work between 10 and 12 hours a day, and I work almost 7 days a week, so. Yeah, it's you just
it is,
can't
okay.
get it done. I'm not very efficient.
Oh.
That's my problem.
I doubt if that's the reason.
That's my problem. So, question number 9, because I know your time is fleeting. I have served on, you could look at my CV, I've served on various search committees. I served on the admissions committee for the medical school. Mm. I have declined the invitation to serve again several times. I don't want to do that. I'm not a masochist completely. I served on the biological sciences division, so worked for making decisions about tenure, and I got courses and things like that. There's been a lot of reorganization of those committees at this point in time. I've served on a lot of committees related to this department, mm-hmm. like Space Committee, and then everybody ignores what I concluded, tenure committees and that sort of thing. The typical kind of thing.
Sure.
I served as chair of the promotions committee for the medical students for several years. Mm. That was not fun. Mm-hmm. I remember getting sued for umpteen million dollars because we kicked a student out of school.
Were any of them fun? I mean, did you enjoy any of the committees that you were on?
I enjoyed the divisional committee. I liked the people, mm-hmm. and I liked getting another perspective on things.
Sure.
I haven't done a lot of service, and a lot of that is because I've done a lot of service outside the university.
Right.
So that sort of has led me to be good at saying no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I guess, and also, you know, I'm aged at this point in time, and I think they need young blood mm-hmm. in those kinds of activities.
Mm-hmm.
So the less I am involved at that level, the more I can do in other places.
Sure.
But I enjoy the opportunity to interact with people and to figure out what they're up to and to learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't learn about how to function well on a committee by reading about it. You have to have that experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's been educational from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been something in which I haven't recently probably done my service as well as I should.
Mm-hmm.
The climate for women, well, it's improved dramatically, as you know. Mm-hmm. Departments are very anxious to hire women. It's tough. The spousal partner hiring business is really tough.
Mm-hmm.
We have two women in this department. One has got a joint appointment in pediatrics, the other was a hire. Offers have been made to other women in the search process and we've lost them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's because their husband has a job at another place and this university cannot provide them with a job that is equivalent to what the woman is getting here, mm-hmm. a real faculty position.
Mm-hmm.
Something just came across my desk a couple of weeks ago, and amazingly, the husband is willing to accept a job as academic staff.
Mm.
That makes it very easy.
Sure.
But most of the time, that's not an acceptable option.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a challenge everywhere. It certainly is a refreshing change from the way it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But there still are problems.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been well articulated by people on campus who've been studying this issue. It's women who take care of children the vast majority of the time. I had one interesting experience because I did serve sometime as a mentor to one of the women in another department in another school. And I strongly advised that she extend her tenure clock.
Mm-hmm.
She would not.
Oh, wow.
Because she felt if she did, her male colleagues would not think that she was really taking her job seriously. I can tell you that my sense was she had a jerk of a husband mm-hmm. who was not going to help her with anything, thank you. And she had a young child, and for some reason there were some sleep problems. She wasn't getting any rest. When I saw her, she was extremely fatigued. But still, you know, you hand out these wonderful little morsels saying, oh, you can extend your gender clock. But then I think people step back and say, well, what does that say about me? I'm not as good, huh? And I'm sure there are much more challenging things than that. Sure. And these have been well studied by many distinguished university committees. Mm-hmm. How do you get women to get involved in science? Well, we've got a problem, and it's not just with women. Mm-hmm. We have a very anti-intellectual atmosphere in this country. We have an administration that just says, oh, that science, it's that, I don't believe that. You know, that just totally trashes scientific studies. They don't understand the scientific method. I think this is a population as a whole. They somehow think, they don't understand that science, how science is done. It's not beliefs and superstitions, it's hypotheses, and then you work on them, and maybe the data don't support the hypothesis. That's the scientific method. But that's, this population is really, really interesting. I think it's becoming more and more of a theocracy. And that scares the hell out of me. Excuse my language on your tape. We've got to really do some major things, because young men are not going into science. And of course, everybody in this country wants to get rich fast. And everything has to be done quickly. And you can't establish a career in science overnight. It's a long, slow, slugging process. We aren't doing a good job of educating young people in science at the grade school level. It has to start there. I know that the National Academy and the National Science Foundation and other major scientific organizations are really working on this. I'm really interested in what's happened to some of my husband's graduate students. He's had almost 100 PhDs. And some of them are close to retirement age, as you might expect. And some of them also got let go by their companies in the reorganization process, like they were in the chemical industry or in the oil industry. And many of these, and they have gone into teaching in high school.
Oh, really?
And they are doing exciting things.
Well, that's nice to hear.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you, because the quality of education in the sciences in many places is terrible. Mm-hmm. All this garbage education doesn't say that someone is qualified to teach a subject. And these people are. They have PhDs in chemistry. They have years of research experience. And we just got a mailing from one of my husband's former students who's creating this foundation for science education in the public schools in New Jersey. It's really great. He wants a donation, of course. So it's not just girls.
Yeah.
It's boys and girls. It's the public has to get out of this business where they trash knowledge, they trash learning. And I'm not saying it right, but you know.
No,
what I mean.
Understand what you mean.
What professional organizations do I belong to? Well, I belong to the American Pain Society and the International Association for the Study of Pain. And I no longer belong to the Society for Neuroscience because I just can't go to their meetings. I guess in terms of professional organizations, I don't belong to a lot of things. I interact with a lot of professional organizations, mm-hmm. but I don't necessarily am a member. Mm-hmm. So for the American Pain Society, I served on the board of directors, and for other organizations like the Federation of State Medical Boards, I will serve as a consultant. For the American Society of Addiction Medicine, I will serve as a consultant. For the American Cancer Society, I will review documents, I will go to committee meetings, I will do things to try to encourage people to work on pain, mm-hmm. things of that sort. So that's my involvement. Mm-hmm. So What do I do when I don't work? Mm-hmm. I garden and read mystery stories. My children are not here, and I guess I'm not a very good example of a balanced life.
Do you travel? You must
travel.
It sounds like you travel for your job. Do you travel for fun too?
No, combined? I don't care for traveling for fun.
You do
no
too much of it, probably.
I have no desire to do that. Traveling mm-hmm. is not much fun anymore. It's become a real tedium. So the only thing I would travel for fun was to see my grandson. That's the only thing I would do. Otherwise, I'm kind of boring and unbalanced. Unbalanced.
Well, it doesn't sound like that to me.
So,
is there anything else you want to add to this?
Because we
I didn't.
I think we got through most of the questions.
Yeah,
yeah, it's it's just so funny because I was never formally hired. You know, I just slipped in. Very shortly thereafter, rules began to evolve so that there would be affirmative action.
Sure.
And, you know, the way we do searches now, my God, people have to practically walk on water to get an offer. I would never have gotten an offer. And then the way I earned tenure, I wouldn't have given myself tenure. But those were not the good old days, but maybe the old days. Things are very, very different now. And I think that's good. I think everyone is more careful, more rigorous, and there is a very, very sincere effort to recruit women and to make sure that those women will be successful.
Mm-hmm.
There are mentoring committees for any beginning professor in a department. I just got asked to be on our new assistant professor's mentoring committee. And their progress is looked at every year very critically. Suggestions are made for change. People help them with their grants. I never got any help with anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't done. Nobody did mm-hmm. anything. I don't think my husband got any help. He just was lucky in that his professor said, you can take your work with you. So he continued what he was doing as a graduate student. But he had a good education.
Mm-hmm.
Sound training, if you will, if you can talk about training.
Sound. Now, did he go to Iowa State?
Mm-hmm. That's how we met.
Oh, I see.
Okay. That's how we met.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We shared an office.
Oh.
Yes. So it's a different world now, a really different world. In some ways, it's tougher, much, much tougher.
Mm-hmm.
Because the number of people who are seeking federal funding has increased. The quality is fabulous. But when you look at the real dollars that are available, there isn't that much, you know, that's gone up. So it's, I don't know what the future will bring.
Well, if I had $5 million, I would give it to you because I think the field you're in is so important. Absolutely. I was really looking forward to this. I had read some about you on your website, and I was really looking forward to this morning to hear more about it.
Well, we really didn't talk a lot about pain. We talked about myself. Pain is.
Well, that's what we're supposed to do, is talk about.
But
you.
It really is sad. I just got a call 2 days ago from a woman who's with the American Cancer Society in Kentucky, and she talked to me about her mom, who's 77 and has spinal stenosis and was put on OxyContin appropriately, but then she had a spinal epidural steroid, and that gave her pain relief, so her doctor took her off her medicine. She went through horrible withdrawal. And my friend is just in such distress about her mom because her mom didn't understand what